truth be told, or your bullshit getting old. The world is getting cold. Don't nobody owe you nothing, so quit fronting. Nothing wrong with being honest. It's a lot of broken promises. Truth be told, we could communicate without all the gun violence. All it took was one conversation. It'll prevent a whole lot of altercation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Truth Be Told. I'm your host, as always, James U. Turner Jr. And today we have HBO Def Comedy, Wild and Out, and YouTube sensation, Mr. Nate Jackson. Welcome, Mr. Nate Jackson, to the show. How are you, Nate? How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks.
Hey, thank you, man. So excited to get you on. I'm ready to get into it when you are.
All right, ready, say go.
All right, so when did you realize that you wanted to do comedy?
I didn't know at first. Somebody dared me. That's how it works. Sometimes you have a talent and or a gift, and you don't even necessarily recognize it or see how it would fit in the world. And there's somebody else who can see it clearly, you know. And so a friend of mine just knew from how funny we used to be on campus every day in college and stuff. He was like, you know, you should try stand-up. And I was like, heck no. He's like, what if there was like a competition with just students from here? I was like, then I'll win. He was like, hilarious. Well, there's a competition on Wednesday. I was like, oh, man. He's like, you better start writing some jokes. And so I did. And that's how I started.
What qualities do you feel you need to be a successful stand-up comedian?
You have to be a little bit off. Not in a bad way, but in like a... you need to be the type of person who can stand at the bottom of a mountain and look up at it and say, all right, let's do this before a hike. You need to be the type of person who understands it's a marathon and not a sprint. You need to be the type of person who understands that what you're building, you're building a career that is not what you're building the foundation of is virtually like if it, like say you started building underwater, you know, because you have so much building you're doing before people can even see you break the surface, you know. And but once you break the surface, it's like, yeah, but I have all this foundation, you know what I mean? It's, you know, so I think you got to be just a little nuts. You got to be able to, you also need to be, it helps to be a realist so that you can make adjustments live. It helps to be, you know, somebody who can really assess what's going on in the moment very well to know where they're at, how well they're doing. And I think having a positive outlook helps, but I mean, I know there's a lot of comics that have been dark or had different outlook, like they weren't necessarily like that, but I think having some positivity matters a lot, like the hope, you know what I mean? Because there's a lot of, this is a business of no's, the thousand no's, everyone says no, you know, and then you can be extremely successful off of like the right set of maybe 15 yeses. Everybody else can say no, but the right 15 yeses and you're a megalostar. So you just have to know that headed in.
Now, being that you got into comedy in a different way, did you like study different stand-up comedians, or did you just kind of like, I'm doing my own material, I don't need to research anyone, I'm doing my own thing? How did you get into that?
Well, yeah, I don't know if I would call it studying. I liked stand-up. I liked watching it, but I didn't know it was for me. So then by the time I was doing it, I actually had a catalog of my own memory that I could, like, think of. Like I knew, like, Eddie Murphy Delirious was just, like, what I thought was just, you know, his opus at the time. You know, I was like, God, that was so funny. That was my first
classic
exposure to stand-up. And I came across that much earlier. Like I was much younger than when I was at a family friend's barbecue, and all the adults were upstairs, and then at some point, like, all the kids went downstairs, and so everybody was just downstairs, and we got there late, and so when I joined the group, it was already going. Like, Eddie was right in the middle of the Goonie Goo Goo, and everybody was hollering, laughing, you know, little kids just bowled over, and then, like, teenagers bowled over, and young adults, and I was like, what is this that he had on his little outfit? And I was like, this is insane. And so I sat and watched it and enjoyed the hell out of it, you know. But I wasn't watching it going, what if that was me or I want to do it? You know what I mean?
All right.
So yes, I was watching stand up, but I wasn't necessarily, cataloging and retaining what I was watching.
Taking notes.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily doing that.
So, those who haven't checked out your YouTube channel, you need to get on that. But what was the inspiration? How did you come up with Surviving Stevie Wonder?
I don't know, man. I just was like, so this is the thing. Like, every time there's a sketch comedy show that's like, looking for new talent or whatever, they always ask me, give us three characters. And so then I was like, all right, well, what men that are black can I do? It's like, you know, there's only so many people available to be acting out, you know what I mean? And so Shannon Sharp, you know, everyone's like, hey, skip, come on, Skip. Like, he'd be a reasonable one. Like, Steve Harvey's a prominent black man, and Godfrey just went viral doing that. So I was just thinking, like, man, maybe Stevie Wonder, like, I could just have him, like, bumping into stuff. You know, what I did not account for was once I shaved and put my facial hair back around my mouth like that and put on a ball cap, that I would look that much like dude. That I really was, like, standing in my own mirror going, this is retarded. Like, this is just insane. You know, and so I all the episodes of Surviving Stevie were shot in one day. I put it all on once, and then just to see if I could. And then the day that we did it, and I had all the, you know, videographer and, you know, and all the homies and all that stuff around, was like, that was all one shoot day. You know, so people keep asking for more of that, but I don't even necessarily have a desire to. I think that's just gonna be what it is. Then I'll move on to doing another character.
Well, that's definitely classic. Now, you wrote and performed for Wild and Out. How did that whole experience come about, and what was that like?
This is a very complicated question, but short version of that is it took me 4 years to get on the show, of different auditions and grinding it out, and, you know, showcasing and being consistent and referrals, and it took a lot to get on that show. Then I got on it, and there's 12 people per episode, and there were 37 cast members because it was their big LA return to LA and MTV1 blowout. So it became very challenging to get on episodes considering how many slots there are. But I was blessed because I did 5 episodes, and all my episodes were big as hell. Like, people were fighting to get on episodes that I actually, the ones that I just got. Like, I got Erykah Badu and Travis Scott and Kay Michelle, Flo Rida, and Antonio Cromartie were all on one episode. Like, I was on that one. Like, we had some big-ass moments. And so, I can't complain, man. Like, Nick Cannon looked out. And from ever since we did that, like, we've been doing, all of us still work together. We all do colleges. We're all on the circuit. We're all working. We're all, you know what I mean? When schools have their back to school, the Wilding Out on Campus type events, whatever, we all do the shows, and there's a live tour, and, you know, and there's only so many stand-ups on the show, so we get consistent work. So I would have to say, overall, it was a phenomenal experience. And then writing for the show is refreshing to see, too, because, you know, like, I've invented games, and I've seen them work, or I've, you know, written many, many jokes, and then I see them come out in different, various forms in the games and stuff, so it just, you know, just lets you, it's kind of dope to just see, like, the world laughing at your, you know, at your jokes, even though, and the thing that's different is that's the first time where I'm not the one saying it. So it's still it's a trip to me to be like, oh, wow, there it is, it worked. You know what I mean?
It's got to be, like, therapeutic in its own way.
Cool. I mean, at one point, I'm like, why can't I be the one that's saying it? What in the hell? But, you know, it's just not the way it works out. You know, just they move on. They want a much younger cast. And so it made more sense to stay in the fold by writing than to, you know, try to fight the entire mold that they're trying to create, you know?
Absolutely. Now, what's the difference between writing jokes on a show like that and writing your own stand-up material?
Stand-up material is linear to me. Like, you know, things need to go in a direction. I need to lead you somewhere. It needs to have a beginning, middle, and end. It needs to have punched-up jokes all the way throughout. Like, a lot of stories and things like that are awesome to tell. And then that's kind of what I've accepted that I am. I'm actually a storyteller. Because I'll tell you a story about a terrible date, you know, and it'll have, you know, four parts in it, and there's punchlines all the way through, and we're having a great time. And we don't realize it, but you just heard 9 jokes about the same night that I went on, you know what I mean? And I'm the blunt of it, or, you know, we have a certain direction which we know we're going, you know? And so when you're writing for a TV show, you're just kind of writing abstractly. You know, you're just giving, you're filling up a binder with potential jokes that one person could say to another one type of thing, you know?
Absolutely. Have you ever had to deal with hecklers, and what's the best venue you've been to so far?
Yeah, I've dealt with hecklers. Everyone has. There's no way not to, you know what I mean? The thing, this is how I feel. I feel like everybody deals with hecklers, but the only time that you really get heckled is when you only really get heckled when there's enough time for the audience to think of things to say, unless they are inebriated. A drunk person doesn't care if it fits. If it fits the show or anything, they're just yelling out random stuff because they're drunk. They're not, you know what I mean? Their hypothalamus is blocked by alcohol-induced fever. But a sober minded person is listening to the show, and the only reason that they would be able to blurt something out is because they can process what you're saying, know what you're about to say, and feel like they have something to interject. Otherwise, they wouldn't. They'd be like, yo, this dude's good enough. I don't need to be yelling out nothing and saying it. You know what I mean? It's about attention. So if your set is, if you're on fire, there's no room for that. They should be, their mouth should be open listening versus closed thinking of shit to say. I don't know if I can cuss. But yeah. So then, best venue. I don't know about best venue. Biggest venue I've been at was I did Summer Jam in Seattle. It was like, I don't know, I think like 80,000 people or something. I don't know the head count, but it was ridiculous. It was like a sea of human. And the way that they do it, the way they do it back home is there's like the main stage where, like, you know, the biggest artists are performing at, and then there's a lot of little annex stages and stuff on the side. So there's a lot of people who get to say, you know, in the lead up of the show that they're performing at Summer Jam, you know, and you get out there to the Gorge in George in the middle of Washington, and there's all these people, and there's all these little stages, and you see all the different people performing, and it's like a fair, like it's just a lot going on. And then everyone leads into the main concert area where the thousands and thousands and thousands of people are, and then that's where you're watching like Rick Ross and Wiz Khalifa and stuff like that. Well, I was on that main show. Like, I performed literally after Rick Ross, right before Wiz Khalifa. Like, it was crazy. That was much younger comic, too. And the radio station was just like, you ready? I was like, I ain't going to be no more ready than I am at this very moment. You know, the guy gave me the mic, and he was like, dude, you're a juggernaut. I was like, thanks. And I just walked out, and I didn't realize at the time what he was saying was that he couldn't believe my amount of fearlessness, because he's a radio jock and he talks to millions of people a day, but he does it in a room into a microphone. To see them was like, you know, shocking to him. And I was like, let me go talk to him. You know what I mean? And so this was like, this was maybe 8 years ago, maybe seven, 8 years ago. And I went out and I told, I don't know, maybe five, ten minutes of jokes. I had them rocking or whatever. And then they're like, all right, start to let them know that Wiz is next. Now, are y'all ready for Wiz? And everybody just start chanting, Wiz, 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 and pulling out weed and all of that. So that was pretty awesome experience to see people who've been waiting for 3 hours, pool wet, soggy, sweaty, blunt out to get them ready for Wiz Khalifa. So I know that'd be a big one. My best live show, my first taping that I ever did was for a show called Bounce TV's Off the Chain. And it's an obscure TV network, but I mean, it's grown since then. But at the time, it was like on a random channel, like channel 235.1 on your cable device. Like it was small. But they were extremely, extremely attentive to the comedians in a way that I hadn't seen even on much bigger production. Like, they were better than HBO. They were better than BET. They were better than even the MTV stand-up special was dope, too. But Bounce TV's Off the Chain was so much more attentive. Like, they provided ground transportation from your house in L.A. to the airport. Then you flew to Atlanta. Then from Atlanta airport to the hotel, they got you. Then they fed you when you landed. Then you sat with Ways and Means, and they talked to you about your jokes and what you can and can't say. And then they put you on the show with other comics that weren't saying anything like what you were saying, not even topically. It was extremely like organized and just conducive for comedy. And then the host was Rodney Perry, who's, you know, a known phenomenal comic. So it was just very, very warm, you know, versus like Def Jam, where like the host does their thing and then walks off, and then there's like 10 cold minutes of just, it's quiet, and then somebody announces you off. You hear your voice, you hear your name through a voice in the sky, and you just come walking out, and then it's like, it's a paid audience and all that. Like, it was a trip to see how awesome Bounce TV could be. Like, they fought for me to do my Frank Ocean joke and get it cleared as a parody, whereas every other network or every other TV show was like, you can't do it without even trying. So that was my favorite TV stand-up appearance. Favorite venue. I do a show in Washington State still once a month at this piano bar called Keys on Main, and it's in Tacoma, Washington, in downtown Tacoma. And it's electric, man. We built an environment where comics, even a young comic who has never really headlined before, like a strong feature, can come in there, full-on headline, and probably get a standing ovation. Like, it's just that electric. Like, the people listen, you know, they want to be entertained, and the audience has been groomed for like a decade of awesome shows, and we've had everybody through there, from Tiffany Haddish to Little Rail to Big Les to Dion Cole, you name it. And we've had everyone. And so we filmed it and put it on Comedy Central for Kevin Hart's Heart of the City, where we had Kevin Hart in town and all that stuff. And so I think that overall is my favorite place to perform. And it's kind of crazy to say, yeah, my own room is the one I like, but no, for real, Keys on Main in Tacoma is the one I think is probably the best built night that's consistent that I like across the board.
Well, and I'm glad you brought up Washington too, because, you know, when you started out, you were going to school, and I was just wondering how hard was that to juggle, you know, going to classes and going to the stage also.
I mean, it wasn't that hard. I mean, you know, my mom at the time was just like, you better graduate. And you can do whatever the hell you want, but you're going to get that damn degree. So it really wasn't that hard. I mean, but at the same time, when you're a new comic, you're new. You know what I mean? So you're moving at your pace. And then you start meeting other comics, and you start to see who the funniest people are in town. And then you start to aspire to be as funny as, you know, you want to be the funniest person in that area code. You know what I mean? So that's what you're working towards. And I started in Spokane, Washington, which was like, I mean, there was like maybe 20 people trying to do stand-up, and two that were really good. One of those two was regularly on Comedy Central, and then and that was Dan Cummings. And then there was like 10 of us that were you know, decent, and we were performing all the time. But it was like its own little small tiny community versus feeling the pressure of like the LA scene, where it's like, I gotta get up. Like, the 10 of us were always up in Spokane, you know what I mean? So I had a half hour of comedy before I even finished school. Like, I was a strong feature before, in Washington, I was a strong feature. By the time I got invited to do shows in Seattle, I already had a, you know, a solid, I had been headlining. It was ridiculous to think I had been, but I had been headlining at that point, you know. When the sample group is that small, the amount of talent I needed to be a headliner was less. Once I got to LA and I was exposed to this big pond and how many people were comics and how many people were talented and how many people were, you know, there was people at coffee shop open mics that were better than people I had seen for the last, you know, 3-4 years doing stand up. I was like, okay, I'm going to have to readjust what I think is worthy of saying on stage. And so I took from 45 minutes at that time, I kept, I think, 5 to 7 minutes. And then I just started rewriting, remaking, rebuilding, creating new stuff at the cadence and the amount of laughs per minute that I felt was what it took to be successful in LA. And I never looked back from there.
Now, speaking of that, in 2010, you won the nationally acclaimed Bay Area Black Comedian Competition. What do you feel you took personally from that experience, and how did it help your career?
The Bay Area Black is a humbling experience, because, see, people say Bay Area Black, and you're like, oh, okay, so you go to Oakland and you just compete against people in the Bay. But no, it was to $5,000 prize. People come from all over the world, and then it was like acclaimed, you know. So like, everyone who's anybody had to go through Oakland at some point. So what the Bay was a great way to, you grind all year long, you make your new jokes, you know, you keep a couple solid ones that are like super good, that are, you know, that you know are bangers. And then you go do them in your 5-minute set there. And then if you advance, you go to the 8-minute round. And from there, you go to the finals, which are like 15 minutes. And so it takes years to win the Bay. Nobody just comes in their first year and wins, unless it's like somebody who's already been a veteran in comedy for a long time. That's the only people who can come in out of nowhere and just get it. So you can see the progression of talent of who might win it in the next couple of years. Like, you'll see somebody get to the semis and like kill it, and then get to the finals and lose, and you're like, yo, next year they'll probably win next year. You know what I mean? It's like watching young boxers. There's no surprises in who's funny. And so the Bay Area was a great litmus guide for where you're at. How was your year? How many did you work? Were you funny? Because you see comics go up and do the same thing they did the year before, like exactly word for word verbatim, and it's like, you didn't work hard enough, dude.
Jeez.
You know? And it worked because the audience is all new, but I'm talking about the comics know, you know what I mean? And so that would be the only way where, like, you go to the Bay and you meet people from Florida and D.C. and Chicago and Canada and London and you know, Texas and all over the country, and they are all the funniest person from where they're from. Everybody's the funniest person. So when you put all those people under the same roof and go, well, who's the funniest out of all of y'all? You know what I mean? So you and see you next year. It adds a chip to your shoulder to be like, look, I got to get funnier than the dude from Detroit because he's hella funny. I got to get funnier than the guy from New York. I got to get funnier than the guy from the same way when you start, you're like, I got to get funnier than the funniest guy in my area code. It doesn't stop. Then you just end up chasing, I got to get funnier than I was the day before, or I want to be funnier than Kevin Hart, or funnier than whoever, you know what I mean? And so, I mean, it took me 4 years to win it. So I did it from 2006 to 2010. 2010 was the year I won.
Hey, well, it's definitely nothing to look over. I mean, you've also been featured on Tosh.0. So What was it like to work with Comedy Central and Daniel Tosh personally?
I mean, that's a cool credit, but that experience was some bullshit. I'm gonna keep it real with you. There was this dude who tried to dunk, and he couldn't dunk. And so Tosh.0 and them, they were doing these things called redemption, where they bring the person back from the funny clip. And they were scrambling to find somebody who was, like, fat, about 6'1", like, you know, and could dunk. And so my agent was like, I got the perfect guy. And she's like, you only get your hair cut? And so they cut, like, they cut my hair all silly. Like, the guy, he was naturally had a fucked up haircut. They cut my hair fucked up. Put, like, some Dr. J goggles on me or whatever. And then, like, I went in there, like, roasted the dude, and then I started dunking. And that was my Tosh.0 experience. It's not like I was and it was a trip because Jasper Red was on there, and he's a comic, and Daniel was like totally embracing him, like, yo, this is Jasper Red. He's a phenomenal comic, and Jasper was like going one, toe to toe with him when they were doing jokes and stuff like that. And then they're like, all right, now for the redemption part, and then I just come out and roast this fat guy and start dunking. Like, it was like a gimmick to the show, you know what I mean? Versus like being fully embraced by the show to rock out. But I mean, people can find the episode. It still pays residual.
Hey, that at least you got that right.
Right.
You also were involved in HBO Def Comedy. How did you get involved, and do you ever plan on doing more work with them in the future?
Yeah, I like HBO, man. I think they I really like how their network allows for the most freedom of expression. And then when I like have looked up like different blog posts or actors talking about their experiences in different places, and they say HBO has always just been the dopest network because they let the talent be the talent and let what grows out of that grow out of that organically versus forcing it. Or, you know, some networks are very heavy-handed where they're like, you know, we want to see the episode before anyone, we don't like it, rewrite it, you know. And HBO's like, let's push it, you know, let's push the fold, let's see what you guys come up with when we just give you a budget and believe in what you create. So I would love to continue to work with HBO. I mean, that's the whole point of me working so hard to earn acting chops and stuff, is so that I can land something on there in that form, like something scripted would be dope. How did I get on the All Deaf comedy? Was just literally from being consistent across the course of maybe 4 or 5 years, where the show was basically casted and booked by talent scouts who, prior to the show's existence, were all of the bookers of the black shows in LA. So they just kind of asked them, like, who do you guys think should be on the show? And then they took, you know, a consensus. They had their own favorites. Russell had people he liked. When I say Russell, I mean Russell Simmons. And then other executive producers had guys they liked over time. And there's all these different showcases all over town and in different cities. And I just was consistent. I was funny in L.A. I was funny the next showcase in L.A. I was funny before it was even known that it was a showcase for that. When they were just kind of hanging out. And, we didn't know that they were there. And so there was a lot of people under consideration for the spot that I particularly got. It was never really locked in all the way up until the Wednesday before I taped. I didn't know if I was really going to tape. Like, it was nuts. There was no security. Like, I felt like I might, you know, go down there to tape, and then they've got another person in my spot, and they're like, oh, well, he doesn't do good, you can go. Like, that's how loose it felt.
Jeez.
You know, and then it really came down to, like, they were trying to rebrand Def Jam to where it felt like chic, new. It was like a wonderful example of hip, not just, you know, it had to be hip, you know what I mean? And so they wanted to, like, give me a makeover, have me dress different, and wanted me to lose a bunch of weight. And I was like, dude, are we going off of funny, or like, what are we talking about? Because the original Def Jam, Tracy Morgan had on a white T-shirt with a chicken grease stain on it and a Tweedledee hat with a spinner on the top. You know, and they're like, yeah, we're trying to update it and all that. We want it to be the most sexy. Like, we want people to tune in on Friday nights and see outfits that they want to wear and just feel cooler from who they were. I'm like, okay, I get that. But what if I just go out and kill, though? You know what I mean? And so we had a happy medium where I had found this, this new brand, and they made Big and Tall clothes that were like dope. Cause you know, big guys, we got to wear stupid shit. Like it just, they all say like Big Dog and Man of the House and like, graphic tees. I'm the one on the grill. Like, come on, man. Fuck. Can we be, you know what I mean? Give me some shit. Like, cause you go into Nordstrom's and they're like, we only go up to 1X. Like, thank you. Appreciate you guys. Have a good day. You know, but so like this brand made dope clothes, high-end stuff for big guys. And so I found these jackets that were pretty dope. And so that's what I ended up wearing. That and the newest Jordans that had came out like a week before. And so everybody was like, all right, cool. He fresh.
Yeah, like, you can't go wrong with Jordans.
Right. Like, goddamn, I know how to dress. Like, you know, but they're like, you know, and what about your stomach? I'm like, what about my goddamn stomach? You know what I mean? So are you going to tell me I can't be big? Because goodness gracious, fluffy is pretty fluffy. And, you know what I mean? And Patrice O'Neal is pretty goddamn big, guys. And I don't think that being fat has anything to do with, you know what I mean? They literally were like, you know, you're in between. You either have to be or morbidly obese to be funny or like, you know, but just being like a big guy, solid guy, we don't know how that's going to work. I'm like, what?
He's like, I'm funny, man.
Yeah, I mean, they literally came down to it. They're like, look, man, we really want you for this spot, but we think we want to maybe have, like, the type of person who wears skinny jeans. And I couldn't believe it. And so I was like, I don't own any skinny jeans, you know. So I don't own any skinny jeans, but I can go buy some jeans that are a little thinner around my legs, I guess. And so I did, and they were happy. And then what we saw on TV is what they were like, all right, that's cool. And then to this day, that's the highest rated episode of the show. I mean, it kind of got pushed under the rug because Russell got in trouble during the Me Too stuff. So HBO kind of distanced themselves from Russell Simmons in particular. But that show had the potential to actually be what everyone said it was going to be. You know, the second coming of, you know, the great return of Def Jam. The original Def Jam is back. You know, it had the potential to be that. But then once Russell cut the Me Too, I mean, they took him off every episode and they pretty much just played it what they were contractually obligated to play. Like, it played on TV like once, and then it played on HBO Go and HBO Now for like 6 months, and then it was gone. And then everybody was just like, yo, winter is coming. And that's what happened to Def Jam.
And went from a Me Too to a U2 and a U2 as well.
Right, and everybody too.
Right. Nate, man, you've been a fantastic guest, man. Thank you for coming on. You've given me some insights about the business that I didn't even know. If you'd like to take the time right now to kind of let people know what you've got going on, what you're working on, and where they can reach you at.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, because I've been hella serious answering all these questions. If you want to like see a whole bunch of funny, man, I have like just an unlimited amount of stupid that I have been organizing and culminating on my Instagram, and that's at Mr. Nate Jackson. And then you can see me live because I'm currently on like a 90 city college tour with comedy clubs blended all in and everywhere. And so my schedule and even more further detail and stuff like that is at natejacksoncomedy.com. And then, like everyone else, I have longer form content in around 3 minutes of just dope stuff on my YouTube, which is just Nate Jackson, and also Facebook. Those two sites, I upload the same stuff to it. So once you tap in, you'll be locked in. Like, there's, you know, I'm the type of guy who's been putting so much stuff online that if you haven't heard of me, once you start seeing stuff, you'll see a lot of stuff. So, you know, come on in and jump in on this journey with me because we're trying to get to the top of this thing.
So y'all got no excuses. And I am, of course, James C. Turner Jr. And you can find me at JP's All Day 1990 on Twitter. and James C. Turner Jr. on IG and Facebook. Thank you all for tuning in, and be sure to tune in next week as well.
So look for Cookie Monster by Nate Jackson featuring Too Short. It's the remix of the viral sensation Cookie Monster song. October 9th, available on all platforms where you stream your music or buy it at.
Nothing but positive vibes all day. Grinding, trying to make a better way. Better listen to what the songs say. Truth be told, you better slow your roll. I've been on the same road before. You know I'm the chosen one. I spit flows from the brain. Young G1.